the Christian family. God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. And make a tree good and its fruit will be good, or make a tree bad and its fruit will be bad, for a tree is recognized by its fruit." There from Genesis 9:1, God blessed Noah and his sons. And we looked at scriptures that connected the idea of Noah and his sons as being a family. Noah, his sons, his wife, their wives, his whole family, his whole house went into the ark. And Noah's family was saved by virtue of him having the faith to build the ark. This is a sort of basic picture of what we think of as a family. We also looked at some things that indicated both in old times and in our own time, families are not always narrowly defined. There's a lot of variation in what a family is. We looked at some statistics fairly briefly showing that there are a lot of households, a lot of households in this country that have unmarried adults living together with children. There are a lot of households that have single adults living together with children. These are family numbers that come from census data, and I'm not going to go back and review the statistics particularly. But while we still have a majority, well, in terms of the numbers of households, actually, if you look at the numbers of children, the majority of children, they say, live in non-traditional families now, either blended families where you have steps, or families where the parents are not married, or families where there's a mother or a father but not both. In terms of the numbers of children under 18, they say that the majority of children in the U.S. now live in non-traditional families. In terms of the number of households, we have at this time more households of married with children than otherwise, but again, there's a percentage of those that are second marriage or multiple marriage experiences and blended families. But the idea of God having blessed Noah and his sons, and the idea of being fruitful, that we want good fruit. We want to have families that will produce good fruit in terms of God's plan, God's purpose for our lives, and in terms of what's best for ourselves and those who are near and dear to us. I did have a question that was given to me about the idea of this statement, "Be fruitful, increase in number, and fill the earth." And I'll just relate that, because I commented that there are scriptures that speak to the idea that God is in favor in some circumstances, certainly, of people not being married. God told Jeremiah not to marry. He specifically commanded him not to do that. We have a few other individuals in the Old and New Testaments that we can identify as having served God without being married. They served God as singles, and they served God very, very effectively. Elijah almost certainly was in that category. Daniel and his three friends were certainly in that category, because as Jesus makes reference in Matthew 19, some are made eunuchs by men. Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were made eunuchs. And so they served God very faithfully. They were very productive in their testimony for the Lord and his plan. But they didn't have a family in the traditional sense. In the New Testament, of course, we have Paul, who testified to the fact that he had a gift. He regarded it as a gift. He wished that others could share the same gift that he had in that respect, that he was able to live a solitary life, a single life. I shouldn't say solitary. He had many companions, faithful companions in the Lord and in the church. But he was able to live a life of holy chastity and to dedicate himself wholly to the work of the Lord. He references the idea that Barnabas was in the same situation. It sure looks like Timothy was also in that same situation of being an unmarried man in the service of the Lord. And of course, we would have the Lord Jesus Christ himself. Now, he was saving himself, wasn't he? He had a marriage planned, but in his human life, by the time when the Jews of his generation would have probably been marrying and starting families, he was engaging in other work and preparing for a different kind of bond, a different kind of marriage. But the question was presented, doesn't be fruitful and multiply mean that we should marry? Well, definitely if you're going to be fruitful in the physical sense, if you're going to have children, then definitely yes, you should marry. But that's not the only way that we can meet the Lord's expectations. Jesus talked about the fact that all of his children, all of his disciples, ought to be fruitful. But it's not in the sense of having children. It's not in the sense of multiplication. I mentioned yesterday with this passage from Genesis, and the same is true of the passage back in the first chapter of Genesis, that it is stated not as a command of God, but as a blessing of God. God blessed them. God said, be fruitful and multiply, increase in number and fill the earth. And the passage back in Genesis also talks about subduing the earth and having dominion over the animals and so forth. But in both passages, it's expressed as a blessing from God. It's part of what God gave us in his benevolence as our nature, as what we were capable of, as what we're able to do. It's not a command. I would say without any equivocation at all that no one, no person alive is specifically commanded anywhere in the scriptures that they should have children. And if you desire to marry and have children, that's a godly thing. If you don't desire to marry, that's also a godly thing, as long as you're going to live a life of holiness. If you desire to marry but you don't desire to have children, that's still a godly thing. And none of us should be pressuring other people to think differently on those matters. I have known a couple of young couples in the recent past who married and did not desire to have children. And in both cases, I counseled them that that's fine, that you don't desire to have children. You're not under any kind of obligation to have children. This is not something that God or the church in any sense requires of you. But be open to discussing this with each other in the future. Don't engrave this in stone, because sometimes as time goes by, our minds change about some of these kinds of things. And in the two instances I'm thinking of, they both changed their minds and both are parents now. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes people make that resolution and they stay with it, and it's the right decision for them. Not everyone's cut out for parenthood. Not even everyone who wants to be married is cut out for parenthood. And we ought not to insist otherwise or try and force people into a particular mold or a particular mindset. Children are described as a blessing from God, as a heritage from the Lord. And my children, I certainly see in that way. But then that's what he was saying here. He blessed them and said, this is a blessing to be able to have offspring, but it's not something that we are compelled to do, not something that we are required to do, not something that is commanded by God for us to do. And that idea of filling the earth, my part of it's pretty full already where I live. And, you know, there's not a great need to produce a lot more people to fill the earth. And we can talk about spiritual aspects and applications, but nevertheless, there is not a biblical commandment or requirement or expectation that everyone should marry, nor that every married couple should have children. Steve? 1 Timothy 2:15, go ahead.
ESV, yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue to obey the love and holiness and substance.
All right. And your thought on that? The passage?
My thought is in agreement with what you've said thus far. What I've studied on this, it doesn't require that she has children, physically give birth. She can fulfill this in many other ways. Similar to the word of qualification for the elders, the word children is a word that is not specific as to gender or as to number. It even allows for the children of that man to be adopted children and various applications like that.
All right. Steve, referring to 1 Timothy 2:15, where Paul refers to a woman being kept safe or saved through childbearing, and saying that could actually, I'm taking it that you're saying that could actually be fulfilled through a number of good works and service to others and caring for others rather than just through physical reproduction of children. Is that the sense of what you're saying there? Okay. All right. Go ahead, Rachel. Yeah, Rachel mentions the idea that the saved through childbirth or childbearing there. maybe in reference to the fact that Jesus was born of a woman, that that Mary brought Jesus into the world in a normal way. And Paul, in other places, talks about how every man now comes from a woman. The original relationship, a woman came from a man, but now we all come from a woman and are interdependent on one another. And we are all dependent on the salvation that came through that child who was born of Mary, yes. Okay? I want to reemphasize on this question, doesn't be fruitful and multiply mean that we should marry? And I want to reemphasize, because it was part of what we were talking about yesterday, that if you are going to have children, then yes, you should marry. Okay? Marriage is the place to have children. That's biblical from beginning to end. It's emphasized over and over again. And there is no appropriate place for the production of children or the behavior that would produce children anywhere except within the bonds of marriage. Now, toward the end of the hour yesterday, I read from the third chapter of Genesis just a little bit there of the description of what happened when Satan seduced Eve into eating the fruit that God had said not to eat. We talked a little bit about this idea that sin has distorted all human attitudes and behavior, and Randy made some references to this in his presentation last night as well, the change in perspective that occurred with the eating of the fruit, how they saw each other differently, and how God covered them. They were very ineffective in covering themselves. Still seems to be a problem, I guess. We're not always effective in choosing our coverings. But due to sin, due to selfish behavior and rebellion, there's tension in human relationships, including the best of marriage. There's dishonesty, there's distrust, which erode and damage the marital relationship. The marriage partnership is distorted by sin. There's a lack of equality. I'm going to tell a little story. My parents were married for almost 73 years. My mom died this past February, and my dad just had his 93rd birthday the other day. And they were, when we celebrated their 70th anniversary a couple of years ago, we celebrated their 70th anniversary, and all of my siblings were around. I have seven siblings. There's eight of us. I'm the youngest of eight children, and you can conclude lots and lots of things from that. But I am the youngest of eight children. All my siblings were around, and we were all sitting around talking. And one of my brothers, I would say one of my older brothers, but they all are, it's all, you know. One of my older brothers asked my mom a question. And it was something that was before my memory. It was when I was either not even born or a very small child, when my family lived in a little house in Oildale. But he asked my mom, he said, "Do you remember the time when it was a Sunday morning and we were getting ready to go to church and there was something that you and Dad were upset with each other? And so you ended up getting the kids ready, and we started walking to church, which was a few blocks away. And then Dad came in the car, and everybody got in the car, and we went to church. And that was it." And my brother says, "Do you remember what that was about?" Now, bear in mind, this had been more or less 50 years earlier, maybe 55, 60 years earlier. And my brother says, "Do you remember what that was about?" And my mom says to him, "Yes, I remember. But let's not talk about it." And we went on to something else. In the best of relationships, there are problems. We all have to deal with the reality of our sinful humanity and our spouse's sinful humanity. We all are damaged. We all have problems. We all have things that we bring into the family, into the marriage, and into the family. There are things that erode and damage the marital relationship. It's a fact of life. Don't be delusional about that. Don't expect otherwise. It's part of the reality of marriage. The marriage partnership is distorted by sin, and there is a lack of equality. I believe that Adam and Eve were more equal in the garden before they ate the fruit than they were after they ate the fruit. There were consequences of her taking the lead, sharing it with him. There was damage done that has affected all of humanity ever since, and is going to affect all of humanity, no matter how much people try and deny the differences. There would have been differences between male and female anyway. I mean, we are only, half our chromosomes are different. The men have an X and a Y, and women have two X's. We're like 50% different in that respect. There are differences, but the differences are heightened by the existence of sin, by the existence of tension, distrust. There are things about my inward being that I would rather my wife of 37 years not really understand. There are things that I prefer to not really reveal of my innermost thoughts to my wife, whom I trust utterly, whom I trust with my life, who I trust with my children, with my grandchildren. But there's not total openness, and there can't be, because of the reality of the fig leaves and the coverings and the sin that has distorted all of our lives. Sin went wrong with the family. It still does. This is just a few lines from an article that was printed in May, May 11th, 2010, by Rich Lowry. The source wasn't really that important to me, but he pointed to a report that was done back in 1965, the Moynihan Report on the breakdown of black families in America. It was a report that was produced in the Johnson administration. Daniel Patrick Moynihan would have been, you know, on the left side of the aisle as far as liberal conservatives concerned. He was working in an administration that was considered to be liberal in that respect. But what the work he produced ended up being pilloried, really being excoriated by the liberal side, by the left side, who had other ideas about how to attack the problems of poverty and race in America. But at any rate, he produced a report, and there's just a little bit of the data that came out in that report. The out-of-wedlock birth rate for black Americans in 1950 was 18%, and there's stuff in the report about how the bizarre slave situation in America had contributed to the breakdown of the family and so forth, as well as thoughts on how to perhaps do some rectification, which ended up being rejected. The out-of-wedlock birth rate for black Americans in 1963 was 23.6%, so it was on the rise. And in fact, if you went into some of the ghettos, if you went into Harlem and some of the inner-city areas, the rate was far higher than that, up in the 40% area of out-of-wedlock birth rate in that time frame. For white Americans at that time, the out-of-wedlock birth rate was 3.07%. Now, you may hear people say that what's going on in the world today has been going on for decades as far as sexuality and as far as people doing things in secret, but the numbers don't bear that out. The numbers for out-of-wedlock birth rate really don't bear that out. Janice?
Is that the figure for 63 or for 1950?
That's the figure for the second date. The out-of-wedlock birth rate in 2008 for black Americans was 72.3%. Now, in his report, Moynihan was saying, if we don't do something, this is just going to get worse and worse. And, of course, it's gotten worse and worse. It has gotten considerably worse, and the out-of-wedlock birth rate for all Americans in 2008 was 40.6%. 40%. 4 out of 10 babies in America are now born without having a married father and mother. That's... Well, from my perspective, I think from a biblical perspective, that's horrific. 4 out of 10 children born in America today are born without having a married father and mother, the out-of-wedlock birth rate. But that's not the only thing that's horrific about that. In the report, in an article citing a report, this article was Teen Sex, More Used Rhythm Method Than for Birth Control. Do you guys read the newspaper like I do? I mean, I see the most bizarre things in the newspaper. Anyway, June 2nd, 2010, and it cites a report. Face-to-face interviews with 2,800 teens aged 15 to 19 during 2006 to 2008. So it's a survey of 2,800 teens. 42% of the never-married teens had had sex at least once. Now, that's not a one-to-one correlation, but I noticed that there were 40.6% of births being out of wedlock and 42% have... No, that's not a correlation at all. But somehow there's a little similarity there that kind of strikes my imagination that, you know, there's a reason why we're having lots and lots of unmarried births, and it's because we're having lots and lots of unmarried sex out there. There's lots and lots of this kind of behavior going on. One of the things they said to me in talking about the family was talk about things that I see as challenges, and I think sexuality is a big challenge to the family structure today. The idea of where sex is appropriate, when sex is appropriate. If we are in any sense influenced, and we are in many senses influenced by television and other media, then the message is that, you know, do what you want to do when you want to do it. And even though sometimes the bad consequences are shown, very often the whole thing is glamorized, romanticized, or trivialized. And I'm not sure which is worse. I think maybe the trivializing is the worst of all. And I'm going to talk about trivializing sacred things in a later lesson here. But 64% of teen boys said it's okay for an unmarried female to have a child. Now, just a few years ago, in 2002, 50% of teen boys said it's okay for an unmarried female to have a child. And I don't have statistics for, say, 1970, but I think it would have been more like 5%, you know. I mean, the percentage would have been exceedingly low, even by then. And if you stepped it back slightly before that, it would have been pretty close to zero that would have been saying it was fine for an unmarried female to have a child. More than 70% of teen girls agreed that it's okay for an unmarried female to have a child. And we're not talking about a situation where someone's been raped and they decide to keep the baby. We're talking about a situation where someone has sexual relations outside of marriage and have a baby. And I personally know several young women who decided they want to have a baby. They didn't have any guy that they wanted to be married to, but they decided they want to have a baby. And so they got together with a guy and they have a baby. And that's an increasingly common phenomenon in our current place and time in the American culture. So the idea of, you know, the two-parent, married, stable family with children is an idea that is being, you know, challenged and assaulted on many levels. And before I go to the next portion here, I want to reiterate part of something I was trying to say yesterday, is that when I talk about these things, I'm not talking about people we need to write off. I'm talking about people we need to be prepared to teach, people we need to be prepared to reach with the gospel, people we need to be prepared to bring into the family of faith. Because if our appeal is only going to be to people who already have traditional families, we have an ever-decreasing target. The target is diminishing. The target is vanishing. We have to be prepared as God's people to deal with people in challenging life circumstances. And now I'm going to take another little side trip. It's not a very important side trip, but I'm going to take it anyway. Michael Manning was talking about his mother-in-law yesterday, and his mother-in-law is my aunt. Mary Crown is my aunt and very precious to me. And she pays attention to birthdays. She pays attention to the calendar, which has the birthdays of everybody in the church on it. And every month, as people's birthdays come around, she gives everybody a present when it's their birthday. And several years ago, she started giving the guys Hawaiian shirts. Okay, she started giving Hawaiian shirts to the guys. And the first one she gave me, I gave away. Not because I was ashamed to wear it, but because it was too small. And so I gave it to one of my boys, and she noticed that. And she asked me why I had given it to him, and I told her because it was too small, so she bought me another one, you know, bought a bigger one. And over the course of several years, she has given pretty much every man in the congregation, South Fairfax and Bakersfield, pretty much every man, more than one Hawaiian shirt over the course of the years. And on any given Sunday, if you show up there, you're probably going to see three-fourths of the men wearing a Hawaiian shirt. It's variety of reasons for that, but you're probably going to see that may be pretty much the dress standard there. So a couple years ago, we had a young couple that we were put in touch with due to connections in Beloit, Kansas. And this young couple was unmarried with children. And he is, and he wouldn't mind me talking about him here. I'm confident of that, otherwise I wouldn't do this because he might stumble across it for all I know. But he's of Mexican-American heritage. He's a very burly, very strong-looking guy, shaved head, has been through a lot of things in life that he's tried to fix, tried to get straightened out. And so we had Bible studies with this couple, and they were persuaded that they needed to be baptized. Now, Javier's standard dress, when he's not working, he manages a store, and when he manages the store, he's got an outfit that he wears for that. But when Javier is not working, his standard outfit is a white T-shirt, which fits snugly, and the kind of loose shorts that come down to just below the knee, they're kind of baggy and go just below the knee, and a particular type of tennis shoe that he likes to wear. And so when we're studying, and he's persuaded that they need to do two things. They need to be baptized, and they need to be married. And the issue is, you know, what's the order in which we take care of these things? But he had a third issue. If I get baptized, do I have to start wearing a Hawaiian shirt? Well, they got baptized and they got married, but he never has worn a Hawaiian shirt. First marriage on record. By the way, this also came up in a question verbally, not in a submitted question. Is there a difference? You see, I just said this was an unmarried couple living together with children. Is there a difference between being married and living together unmarried? I mean, they were, what's the expression for that? No, they weren't. Cohabitating, that's not the word. The word for one man, one woman, what's that? Monogamous, yeah. Monogamous. And that word, that tail end of that word, the gamos, that refers to a woman. It refers to one woman. But it also refers to one wife. In the Greek, it's not distinctive. It depends on the context, whether you read that as woman or wife. And that has to do with the fact that in Rome, they didn't have real clear, sharply defined marriage laws. The Roman Empire did not have a clear standard and tradition of marriage that was culture-wide by any means. And the Romans themselves were very casual about marriage, by and large. But within that context, the Jews had very strict rules, very strict laws about marriage, very strict understanding of what marriage is. And they did not understand, and if you want evidence of that, turn to the story of Jesus talking to the woman at the well in the fourth chapter of John. They did not understand cohabitation to be equivalent to marriage. We have Jesus talking to the woman at the well in the fourth chapter of John, and I think, personally, I think with a smile, but nevertheless, he challenges her, "Go and get your husband." And do you remember what her reply was? "I don't have a husband." And Jesus said, "What you say is true. You have had five husbands, but the man you have now is not your husband." Well, you know, she's quite a model for something. She was a mess and she knew it. And in that conversation, she promptly tried to change the subject because she didn't want to talk about that very much. She shifted the subject and brought up the idea of worship and how the Jews were trying to restrict the Samaritans and all that. But Jesus drew a clear distinction. You've been married five times. You have had five husbands. And she's living with a man at the time, but without benefit of marriage. They have not married. They are not husband and wife. He says that from prescience. He says that from his knowledge as the divine Son of God, because nobody told him that. He hadn't been to the Hall of Records to check the status. He knew that about her because he could see her life and her history and knew who she was and what she was. But he drew a distinction there. And it's a distinction that is consistently drawn in Scripture. There's a difference between fornication and marriage, obviously, even persistent fornication, even repeated fornication. There's a difference between an out-of-wedlock relationship and a marriage relationship. The one is sinful, the other is sanctified. The one is wrong, the other is blessed by God. Even though, to outward appearances, if you don't ask a lot of questions, you may not realize whether a couple is one or the other, but the difference is real with God. And there is conversation repeatedly, and one of the scriptures I'm going to bring up shortly here has the word covenant in it. What is a covenant? It's more than an agreement. It's a bond. It's a contract. It's a binding agreement. Okay, and a marriage involves a covenant. It involves a binding contract. Now, marriage in the days of Jesus, you didn't have the benefit of going to a Roman justice of the peace and getting, you know, a stamp of approval. It was done religiously. It was done through the synagogue. It was done through the religious structure and the family that existed there. And we may come to a time, this is a sidelight, but it's an aspect of where we are. We may come to a time in the near future where we are in a position that our government no longer defines marriage in a way that is appropriate and meaningful, because this is a you know, it's a hot potato issue all over the country. California, Iowa, East Coast, it's going to be everywhere that we're going to have this as an issue, what marriage is. And we may come to the place where participating in civil marriage is no longer meaningful as far as biblical covenant relationship is concerned. But we can't go to the place where we don't continue to honor the idea of covenant relationship in marriage. The church is going to be in a position where we still have to have some kind of vow, some kind of binding agreement between individuals, whether the government participates in that or not. The government may stop participating in that as time goes by, or may define it in such a way that it's just not meaningful to us. But we have to understand that marriage is a binding covenant, a binding contract between consenting individuals, and not just individuals, but also involving God as a party to the agreement. And that is also reiterated a number of times in Scripture, including one passage that I'm going to have here shortly. All right, the first marriage we have in Scripture is Adam's marriage to Eve, and God arranged that. And they had their, you know, the benefit of the perfect gene set that God had created, and Adam was taken out of Eve, and I've always thought it was really utterly appropriate. You know, God can do science too, but actually he kind of wrote the book, didn't he? But we have the woman taken out of the man, and if the contrary had been the case, we'd have all kinds of questions of how in the world that could be the case, because the man has both X and Y chromosomes and the woman only has X chromosomes. So I can see, you know, the taking of the woman out of man, but the opposite would have been strange, to say the least. Never mind. Abraham apparently married his half-sister. Is that right? Abraham married his half-sister? Are you sure that's right? Because I'm not sure that's right. I'm sure Abraham said it. But what was the context? I'm impugning Abraham just a little bit here. But Abraham had just been lying about Sarah, right? Abraham had said, she's my sister. And then he'd been challenged because, oh no, she's your wife. And Abraham said, well, she's my half-sister. She's the daughter of my father, but not my mother. And I suppose he is telling the truth at that point, but since it's in the midst of trying to fix a lie, I'm not 100% sure, but I suppose that he's telling the truth at that point. That's the problem when people lie, you know? When people tell a lie and then they try and give you an explanation for the lie, are you sure they're giving it to you straight? When they've been caught in a lie and then they try and give you an explanation when next time around, it makes it a little hard to be sure whether you can take their word or not. But Abraham said, she is my sister, the daughter of my father, not my mother. And assuming he's telling the truth at that point, if I turn to Leviticus 18 and 9, what would I find regarding a man marrying the daughter of his father? Is that a good thing? Not under the law, no. Under the law, that was absolutely forbidden. It says, the nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother, whether born at home or elsewhere, their nakedness you shall not uncover. And even though I don't really like that expression, in a way I do like that expression that's there in the King James and New King James, because it's a little bit broad, and sometimes we need to understand that, unlike a former president that we had that tried to parse the meaning of sex, you know, this is just talking about any kind of intimate contact. This is just really covering the whole gamut of intimate contact there. But no, later in the law, now see, this law didn't exist when Abram married Sarai. This didn't exist, and I'm not impugning him as far as that. But in the law of Moses, the relationship between Abram and Sarai would have been forbidden. The later generations, God said, don't ever do that. Okay? And then we have Abram's servant who arranged for Isaac's marriage to Rebekah, who was Isaac's double first cousin once removed. Everybody knows what that means? Yeah, Abraham's servant went up, you know, to Paddan Aram to get a wife for Isaac, and he went to Nahor's family. Nahor is Abraham's brother. He went to the family of Bethuel, who would have been Isaac's first cousin. Bethuel and Isaac would have been first cousins. And then he found the daughter of Bethuel. And so Isaac and the daughter are first cousins once removed. But Bethuel is also the first cousin of Sarah, if she's the daughter of Terah. So Isaac is also the first cousin once removed. Okay, you got the idea? If you ever diagram Abraham's family tree, it keeps going back on itself. it's really an interesting thing how God chose and used that family. Jacob bargained for his wife, Rachel, who was his first cousin. But remember, his mother was a first cousin once removed double to the, you know, parent here. Anyway, his first cousin, but more than that also in terms of second cousin relationships. And he was tricked into marrying her sister Leah as well. And Leviticus 18:18, nor shall you take a woman as a rival to her sister to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive. The law later forbade a man marrying sisters. There was a question yesterday that was also given to me orally about polygamy. Yeah, don't know why I'm having trouble with that word right now, but polygamy, a man having multiple wives. Name me anybody in the Bible who had multiple wives. Who? What? Laban, the one in the fourth chapter, the descendant of Cain, Lamech there had two wives, married, I think it's sisters that he married. Wasn't it sisters that he married, or was it not? I may be misremembering that part. But, yeah, that's where it first comes up. We find it with Abraham. We find it with Jacob. We find it with Moses, probably. It looks like Moses probably had two wives because he had a Midianite wife, and he also had a Cushite wife, and even though we don't know the story behind the Cushite wife, she may have been his first, it's impossible to know. But he seems to have had two wives anyway. And, you know, we go forward, and we have David, of course, who had a number of wives. We had Elkanah that was mentioned yesterday, who had his two wives. Is that something that God intended? Was that the plan of God? No. It was not the plan of God, and yet God put up with it. God put up with it, but did it... As far as you know, can anyone give me an exception to this? As far as you know, did it ever turn out well? As far as I know, it never did turn out well. As far as I know, every single story involving polygamy is a story of trouble, of conflict, of family divided against itself. It's a story of unhappy people. Anybody know of an exception to that? I don't know of any exception to that. And we're going to get around to some scriptures where this idea of having multiple wives in the New Testament is very explicitly addressed. And really the law of Moses did not sanction it, but acknowledged in the same sense that it acknowledged divorce as a reality, it acknowledged the multiple wives as a reality, but never really sanctioned it as an appropriate relationship. Judah arranged his son Er's marriage to Tamar, then his son Onan's marriage to Tamar, then was tricked into fathering twins with Tamar. I had some things in mind when I put this list together. How did Adam come about having a wife? God set him up with a blind date. And it worked really well, you know. But he had no part in choosing his wife. He saw the wife that God gave him, and you know, yes, it was a big wow. He was very pleased with what God had produced. He was happy with the outcome. But he had no part in choosing his wife. And Abraham apparently married his half-sister, and I suppose they probably grew up in the same household together, and I suppose that he chose his wife. I don't know, but I suppose he did make that choice. Isaac had no part in choosing his wife. And Jacob chose his wife, but got kind of fooled into having a different woman as his wife in the situation there. And Judah, as a father, arranged for the marriage of his son Er to Tamar. When Er died, he arranged for Tamar to be married to his second son, Onan. When Onan died, he promised to arrange for Tamar to be married to his third son, which is later written into the law, Levirate marriage. It's referred to marriage in the brother's family to keep the lineage alive. But he never got around to that, and Tamar seduced him, pretending to be a prostitute, and he fathered a child by his daughter-in-law Tamar, and we're told that they never had physical relations again. But once again, this was a relationship that would be forbidden in the law of Moses, that a man would marry or have relations with his son's wife. That would have been a forbidden relationship. But what works best for marriage? You know, what we are accustomed to is the idea of romantic pursuit. Worked well for my son Thad. He saw this gal Ann, and he said, I think that's the one, and he pursued her, and it worked. You know, he caught her, he was able to win her affection, and worked out really well in that respect. But as far as marriages are concerned, what works best? And the answer to that is kind of ambivalent. What works best is whatever people decide to make work. There have been lots and lots of instances of arranged marriages or marriages that came around by some means other than romantic decision that work very well. There are lots of places in the world today where arranged marriages are still the norm, still the rule. And what matters is the commitment you bring in, the expectation you bring into the marriage, whether you're going to be able to make that marriage work or whether that marriage is going to end up failing. And when I say you, each of us needs to consider that in and for ourselves. Jesus spoke of marriage because he was asked about it in Matthew, the 19th chapter, verses 3 through 12. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? And they really meant any and every reason. If they were just got mad one day, that's sufficient reason for divorce, maybe. Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female, and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And I'm going to throw this in. I had an email back when Proposition 8 was on the California ballot. Because we have a website that has church information on it and so forth, I got an email from a guy who mailed everybody he could find on the internet in California that had any kind of church association and had an email address. And it was an email that was full of misinformation, misdirection, and, misrepresentation. It said, for example, that in the law of Moses, homosexuals were condemned to death, and that's true. And it also said that, what was the example that was used there? I don't remember if it was eating, I think it was eating fish without scales, I think was the example used. The people who ate fish without scales were condemned to death, something very analogous to that. But of course that wasn't true. That's not true. You do know that that wouldn't be true, right? Were the Israelites supposed to eat fish without scales? No. If it didn't have scales, it was considered unclean. But what happened if someone who ate food that was unclean? Did they put them to death for eating food that was unclean? No. They would be unclean themselves. They would be cut off from the community until they went through a cleansing ritual. Okay. But those things were being correlated in this particular email. And that particular email also said that Jesus never said anything about homosexual marriage. Well, actually, he did right here. He said something very definite about it right here when he reiterates the original definition of what marriage is, and there's no room for waffling or exception or alternative in this definition. He says, haven't you read, at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. There's no equivocation there. There's no other idea that's going to come into play as to an alternate expectation or arrangement there. A man, a woman, a marriage, they become one. So they're no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Jesus is emphasizing the seriousness, the sanctity of marriage, that marriage should be entered into with an expectation that it's going to be a lifelong commitment. That's the intention, and that's what needs to be worked toward. And as with our scripture references to Sarah and to Rachel, when they talked about building a family, it's a building project. The word house in the Old Testament, the word house in the New Testament, that's the general word for family. And you don't get a house by wishful thinking. You get a house by pouring a foundation, building walls, putting on a roof, etc. It's a project. It's something that requires a lot of effort, a lot of continued endeavor to get that done and to keep it. And even once it's built, there's never-ending, and I speak from experience, there's never-ending need to keep fixing stuff, to keep the upkeep, to keep it all working. There's stuff wears out, and stuff's got to be repainted, and plumbing has to be replaced, and and there's insect damage, and on and on. Need for maintenance, marriage, and within everything about the family. Which tomorrow I'm going to be talking about parents and children a little bit, and we'll talk a little bit more about other aspects of some of the maintenance that has to occur there. But they're no longer two; they're one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. And so they said, well, then why did Moses put the command about divorce in the law? And if you look at the command about divorce, the structure is that Moses says, if a man divorces his wife, because this is already an existing situation, this is already a, as Jesus says, there are hard hearts involved, and this circumstance was already there. And Moses is regulating, he's limiting what's already in practice there. Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. Where would Adam have gone? You know, that God gave him one choice. And realistically, I think that's the kind of mindset he'd like us to have when it comes to marriage. A single choice has been made. This is the choice. This is it. And he would like for us to make that work. The disciples then, okay, so he talks about adultery, and I'm not going to dwell too much on this particular message, but in the teaching of Jesus, if there's divorce and remarriage, what is there? There's adultery. Either a divorce is caused by adultery, or else remarriage results in adultery. Those are the only two ideas that he presents on that. Whenever there's divorce and remarriage, adultery is always in the picture somewhere. Now, you know, is adultery an unforgivable sin? It's not an unforgivable sin, but it is a sin, and it's a serious sin. And I'm going to have a few scriptures that I want to share with you about that. But the Bible addresses the sin of adultery many, many times because it is a pervasive human problem. Look at the emphasis on sexuality in our culture today, in the media, in so much of entertainment. Look at the emphasis on sexuality today. Adultery and all kinds of sexual promiscuity, sexual immorality, porneo, is a pervasive negative influence on the psyches of men and women, of adults and children. It's something that we really have to contend with on a constant basis. So I tell you, he says, anyone who divorces his wife, verse 9 there, except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman, commits adultery. The disciples said to him, if this is the situation between a husband and wife, it's better not to marry. And for some people, it is better not to marry. We've already talked about that. Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way. Some people can handle living without a spouse, and that's good. That's fine. Others were made that way by men. The Ethiopian eunuch and the other Ethiopian eunuch and Daniel and his friends. Some people are made that way by men, and they don't even have a choice about it. And others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven, and Paul would surely fit into that category. Now, maybe he didn't have as strong a drive as other men have, but I don't think he had no drive from the things that he writes. He understands human relationships very well, but he renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it. But Jesus in this teaching says to us, marriage is a very serious commitment between a man and a woman and God. And we really need to do our best. We really need to invest ourselves in our marriages. If we marry, we really need to do that. Proverbs has a whole section that just keeps coming back to the idea of watching out for adultery. Proverbs is written by who?
Solomon.
And it's addressed to who? His son. All right. I don't know if that was Rehoboam. He's the only named son that we have for Solomon, so I suppose it was. But what does the son of a king potentially have, by way of trips and hazards in his life? Well, pretty much anything you can imagine. The wealth and power of the position, he probably pretty much had anything that he would care to have available to him in one way or another. But the book of Proverbs is written from a masculine perspective, a father addressing his son. I think the teachings are equally apropos to females, to girls, to women. But they are presented in a masculine perspective of a father addressing his son. And he says to his son, Proverbs 2, 12 through 19, wisdom will save you from the ways of wicked men, from men whose words are perverse, and there are a lot of those, who leave the straight paths to walk in dark ways, who delight in doing wrong and rejoice in the perverseness of evil, whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. It will save you also from the adulteress, from the wayward wife with her seductive words, who has left the partner of her youth and ignored the covenant she made before God. For her house leads down to death and her path to the spirits of the dead. None who go to her return or attain the paths of life. So he warns his son here against two particular things. What are the two things? Watch out for men who would what? lead you astray, lead you into evil, all right? Who would seduce you into doing wrong. And watch out for, what's the other thing? An adulteress, a seductive woman. Watch out for a seductive woman. Randy dealt with this a little bit last night in what he was talking about with, you know, learning to turn your head, learning to just turn away from some kinds of attraction. The male psyche is attuned to noticing the female physique, and you got to make a choice about not being drawn where you don't need to be drawn, where you ought not to go. And that is emphasized in this passage. And again, it's emphasized and reemphasized in the book of Proverbs as a pervasive temptation that young men especially, but men in general, need to stay away from. And I think in 21st century America, it needs to be reemphasized again and again that this is a temptation that men, young and all, need to stay away from. There are plenty of opportunities to leave the path and go down crooked paths and get involved in inappropriate sexual behavior. And it is always, as he says here, this goes down to death. Her house, the word house, you know, that's like the word family, right? But he's not talking about a family here, except in the very negative connotation, like the fruit of the bad tree that was referenced there by Jesus. You know, good tree, good fruit, bad tree, bad fruit. This kind of involvement you don't need. And I chose to use this passage in part because of what it mentions in verse 17. The partner of her youth, okay, she made a commitment, and she's not keeping it because she got bored or whatever else. Eagles had a nice song about that, about the gal that married for money and got bored with the guy and likes to go across town and meet the young, exciting guy that she wishes, you know, it's been romanticized. Of course, in there, you can't hide your lying eyes, but you rarely really get away with things. But her house leads down to death, her paths to the spirits of the dead. But she ignored the covenant, and I just wanted to reemphasize that word. She ignored the covenant she made before God. This is the same thing that Jesus reminded the Pharisees of, a covenant made before God. She ignored that. She broke the covenant. She broke trust. There's a singer, country and western singer, who has a group called Bailey and the Boys. She hasn't been very active for several years, but she recorded a song that has a line in it: if she wants a man who'd take the ring off of his hand and then turn around and say that he'll be true, then she deserves you. And if you can figure out what those lyrics mean, it's a song that I have liked for a long time. But basically, if you think you can trust someone who betrays the marriage vow, who betrays that covenant, you've probably got another thing coming. This is an indication of bad character, that this is an indication of failure in many aspects of life. Adultery is a destroyer. Adultery can seem very attractive. In fact, it is romanticized in a lot of romance literature. I'm so tempted to bring up something that is completely out of category here, but I was recently somewhere where I mentioned the Twilight series, and pretty much nobody in the whole church had any idea what I was talking about. Raise your hand if you know what the Twilight series is. Okay. Raise your hand if you're over 30 and know what the Twilight series is. Okay. All right. Only because you have kids. Here's my hesitation with you know, are those books nasty? No. Are they evil? No. Do they depict illicit sexual behavior? Are they explicit? Are they any of those kind of things? No, not from what I've heard. I haven't read them. Okay. A lot of times I've read the books that I talk about when I bring up something. I haven't read those. But there's still something about them that disturbs me. And that's, you know, what are vampires? Bloodsuckers. Are they romantic figures? Well, they are in Twilight. Surely, come on, the vampires are romantic figures in Twilight, and the idea of someone seeking redemption—that's a good theme. I like that theme, but romance literature in general kind of makes me a little bit nervous. In the same way, well, in much the same way that pornography bothers me, that men are drawn to the images in pornography, and that really impedes their ability to appreciate reality. Okay. And women are drawn to the images created in romantic literature, and it impedes their ability to appreciate reality. These things, you know, the difference between men and women, these two kinds of attraction really are kind of side by side with each other, and they're not, at best, they're not altogether healthy, you know, and it's something to kind of be aware of and wary of. The seduction of the mind, the romanticizing of things that really aren't very romantic at all, and the building up of romantic ideas, of expectations that are never going to be realizable, that are never going to be found in this real world in which we live. It's something to be kind of wary of, something to kind of think about and be aware of. So adultery can seem very attractive. I knew a woman who was fascinated with romance magazines, and she became fascinated with pursuing things that she should never have pursued. And I think there was a relationship between those, but not everybody. Very attractive, but very destructive. Adultery is to be avoided not because of some arbitrary system of values, but because it is contrary to the created nature of human beings. God did not make us for multiple sexual partners. He made us for monogamous commitment. We were designed for that in terms of the male and female aspect of our relationships. Men and women are designed to have a lasting physical and emotional relationship with commitment. Defying our uncreated nature will always harm us. Marital loyalty, on the other hand, produces the satisfaction God designed marriage for. A man and woman should make a conscious decision, as often as needed, because you don't just make this decision once, to enjoy the physical, mental, and spiritual resources their spouse brings to their partnership. A person must choose to rejoice, to be satisfied, to be captivated by their spouse, and not to look elsewhere. The Bible asserts that we can choose to make our relationship better and stronger and more satisfying, but commitment and work are required. And this passage from Proverbs 5, I like the surrounding passage, but for brevity's sake, I'm only going to use these verses. Proverbs 5, 15 through 21. Speaking to his son and using allegory, using metaphorical language, and I think it's very beautiful metaphorical language that he uses here. Speaking to his son about a relationship with his wife, he says, "Drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Should your springs overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. Why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the bosom of another man's wife? For a man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all his paths." The part there in the 19th verse about always being satisfied and captivated, that does not just happen. That's a matter of choice. One of the things that I always remind young people of before, you know, doing wedding ceremonies with them is the fact that they're not going to stay like they are. You're not going to be young forever. You may be thin and attractive now, but you may not always be thin and attractive. The blemish-free skin, well, let me tell you, these things change. Lots of things change. And if what you're in love with is an image, it's not going to last. The reality of what he says here about always being captivated, always being satisfied, comes from reinvesting over and over and over again, realizing how blessed you are to have the mate that you have, and I am very well blessed to have the mate that I have, and reinvesting in a decision that this is where you want to be in life. This is what you want in life. And trying to convey that then to your partner, that you are where you want to be, and you want to make sure they're where they want to be, and to work together on mutual satisfaction. This section in Proverbs 6, 20 through 26 is also about adultery, and I'm not going to read the entire passage today. But he says, "My son, keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Bind them on your heart forever. Fasten them around your neck." Where does that come from, that 21st verse there? Bind them on your heart forever. Fasten them around your neck. Where does that come from? Deuteronomy 6, where it talks about the law. It talks about the teachings of God. And here is a specific emphasis on one of those commandments, the one that says do not commit adultery is the one that's in emphasis here. When you walk, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. When you wake, they will speak to you. And again, this is referencing that teaching in the sixth chapter of Deuteronomy. Talk to your children about the law. Talk to your children about the teachings of God. When you get up in the morning, talk about them. When you're walking together, talk about them. Before you go to bed at night, talk about them. Have them on your heart. Write them on your forehead. Write them on your hands. Surround yourself with the Word of God. He is using that same concept here to emphasize staying away from immorality, staying away from seductive people who would draw you into inappropriate relationships and into adultery and prostitution. I will mention, I like this 26th verse, the last verse there, the prostitute reduces you to a loaf of bread. And that can be taken as saying prostitution, using prostitutes will make you a pauper, will make you poor. But really it's saying going to prostitutes, you're being treated as a commodity. You're being reduced to something consumable. And you need to really have a realistic perspective of that. That illicit sexual relationships reduces you to a commodity. You have become a thing, and you're treating the other person likewise as a commodity, as a thing. But coming back to the beginning of this passage, the reason I retained this passage in my trying to prune and decide what to keep and what to lose, my son, keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teachings. You mean mothers and fathers talk to their children about not committing adultery? Well, they better. Because I'll tell you, there are lots of sources that are trying to talk them into committing adultery, fornication, et cetera, et cetera. I was watching a TV show that I like. There are a few of them. It's called Royal Pains. Not endorsing it, but I enjoy it. It's about a doctor. And in the course of this show, there is a female doctor who hasn't got a clue how to have an appropriate relationship with a man. And she's talking to another woman who is engaged to be married and who is a virgin, and the man she's engaged to is a virgin. And she issues the advice, well, you better get together and try it out, because how do you know that this is going to work if you don't get together and try it out? And this advice is coming from a person who in the series, of course, is depicted as a total failure in relationships. But nevertheless, it's the kind of advice the world is giving. Okay? And parents better give better advice than that. Had better instruct children in the realities of the choices that we need to make. My son, keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Yes, fathers and mothers need to teach their children about appropriate sexual behavior. We have a responsibility there. We need to teach this because there is contrary teaching going on all over the place, all kinds of sources. And that's where I'll stop for today.